Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is an MCrit Wii. Now, it's not Wii by length. This could be a full-length podcast by length, but it's follow-up stuff. It's not original material. So I figured I'd make it a Wii. I wouldn't supplant one of the podcasts.
Before we get started, I just want to have a moment of silence for John Marks, editor of Rosen's, a hero of emergency medicine, someone who's contributed so much to our specialty. He passed away a couple of days ago, so let's just stop for a second and remember one of the greats of emergency medicine. All right, John, you will be missed.
And the first thing I wanted to follow up on is actually an airway case presented by my friend Darren Brody on MRAP. If you're an MRAP subscriber, before listening to what I'm going to say, you should listen to Darren's case. It's the lead-off audio portion of the July episode of EMRAP, and it's fantastic. But I'm going to fill you in on the case details so I can make some comments about it. Now, the first comment I want to make is that none of this that I'm going to say is in any way to indicate there was anything except perfect management done by Darren and his colleague, Joy Cook, because this is all Monday morning quarterbacking, and this is all just additional opinions added to the excellent airway management that they demonstrated in the course of dealing with an insanely hard case. I just have some thoughts and stuff to put out there. I'm not saying this is the right way. I'm just saying this is some additional things to mull over. So let me make that abundantly clear. So Darren and Joy Cook had a horrible case of a 200-kilogram middle-aged man with a history of CHF and COPD, probably in the throes of an active pneumonia. And he had a two-hour ground transport to their institution. And in the course of that transport, he was getting tons of albuterol. He had a nasal cannula on. And over that, he had an EMS CPAP device. Now, most of these EMS CPAP devices have a max CPAP delivery around 15 centimeters of water. I imagine he was somewhere around that range. Despite all that treatment, by the time this patient got to their institution after his two-hour transport, he was only sating 70%. He was tachycardic, and he was tachypneic. But the EMS crew said he actually looked better than when they got him. So this guy had to be in really dire straits when they first started. All right, so 70% sat, tachycardic, tachypneic. Everyone obviously knows this guy needs to be intubated. And they did all the appropriate stuff. They got a whole bunch of hands to help. There were already the two attendings in the room. There was a senior resident named Jeff, and they got all the possible difficult airway equipment you can imagine, and they had it all at the bedside opened, which is fantastic. Now, let's just stop for a second and think through the physiology here. If you have a guy only satting 70% on CPAP, which is, you know, this is beyond what I talk about, 70% on a non-rebreather, well, that's shunt. 70% on a CPAP mask, one of two things is going on. Either they have hemodynamic hypoxemia, which is a whole other podcast, and unlikely in this guy. His vital signs at this stage of the game, except for his SAT and respiratory rate, seemed okay. He wasn't hypotensive. He wasn't demonstrating poor cardiac output. What he was demonstrating is persistent desaturation despite CPAP. Well, the other reason besides hemodynamic hypoxemia is shunt atelectasis, alveolar filling that's just not being resolved with the level of CPAP the patient is on. And that's probably what was going on in this gentleman. He already has a lot of risk factors for that. He has triple respiratory problems, and he has morbid obesity, which predisposes you to collapse despite reasonable levels of PEEP. And what these guys need is they need a cuffed tube in their trachea to allow for PEEPs of the level of like 25 or 30 centimeters of water, and that's what it's going to take to start getting some alveolar opening on these patients to get their shunt better. So that's probably what's going on in these guys, but you don't really care. What you have to understand is he needs to be tubed, and you have to figure out the safest way to do it. Now, what Darren and his team, and Dr. Cook's team, what they went with is they chose to go with an awake intubation, which I think is absolutely the right choice on this patient. He, despite his low SAT, it's been at persistently that same low SAT. He has a mental status, not a great one. He's trying to pull off that mask, but he's got a mental status, and he's breathing. Well, you don't want to take that away if you could avoid it. So they very appropriately chose awake intubation, and they chose a ketamine-aided awake intubation. They gave a milligram per kilogram of ketamine, so about 200 milligrams in this patient, and they nebulized in some 4%, and then they were getting ready to take a look. Now, they did all the additional right stuff in a morbidly obese patient. They ramped them, which I imagine, because I know Darren, was ears to sternal notch. They did not lie him down. If you lie these guys down, it's game over because they're going to get massive collapse. Their lung dynamics are going to change. They're going to get much more atelectasis. And so you don't do that. You leave them sitting up and you get something next to the patient's head that allows you to reach them, not put them to you. That means usually that I'm standing on a box or some kind of metal frame that puts me 2 feet higher than my already not so high stature. And you put the bed down as low as possible. And that way you can reach the mouth without having to lie the patient down. Now, they took a look awake, and they were using a video scope, CMAC, got in there, and they saw cords. Now, the problem is, before they could pass the 8-0 and a tracheal tube they had loaded, the patient began desatting. Now, he's already at a critical level. 70% is already really bad. So when he starts getting lower, they very appropriately aborted the attempt. Now, here's the first thing that I'm going to put out there, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but anytime I'm doing an awake intubation on a patient who's either semi-elective or emergent, I'm using a bougie right up front because I need to get that in as soon as possible. And sometimes getting in the endotracheal tube in, even when you see the cords, is tough. But the bougie, it's so thin and it has that Coudé tip, it's a lot easier to get in on that first pass with no obstruction whatsoever. So I always use the bougie. Now, I'm going to go one step further and say, in a case like this, I would use something I've been playing with lately, which is pre-loading the bougie in the mouth before I look for the cords. Now, this could happen in one of two ways. What I've been doing is actually, as I'm putting the endotracheal tube in, searching for the epiglottis, before I've even done any lifting, I've just advanced the blade down the tongue, I am putting the bougie in to the patient's right molars. So now the bougie's hanging out in the side of the mouth already before I've even exposed glottis. Now what this allows me to do is the second I see glottis, I put in the bougie. There's no looking up. There's no asking for someone to hand me the bougie. There's nothing. As soon as I see cords, I'm bougie in. Boom. That's it. I'm not having to stop. I'm not having to avert my gaze from what I'm looking at to find the bougie. First, put it in the mouth. It hits the teeth, hits the lips. The person handed it to me the wrong way. No, it's in my hand. Second I see cords, boom, I'm in. I would be doing that in this case. That's what I'm doing in all of my tough intubations now, is I'm preloading the bougie before I expose the glottis. The other way is if you forgot to do that and you're asking someone to hand it to you, if you've trained your team beforehand, what you could do is have the people, instead of handing you the bougie and potentially handing it to you the wrong way, potentially you having to look up to find where the bougie is in space before you look back down at the mouth to put it in. Instead, they could load it into the mouth to the level of the right molars. And so what I do in that case, if I'm helping someone, helping a resident, is I take the cheek, I pull it back, and I put the bougie in until it's at the molars, and then I say, it's ready for you. And then they could grab it, and it's already where it needs to be, which is right as it's about to disappear behind the tongue. This has helped immensely in me not losing visualization in a difficult airway. Consider it. If you're going to do it, train your team beforehand. Now, there's another thing. Like, let's say I've preloaded myself. I put the bougie into the molars, and it turns out I need to suction. I'll have a team member grab the bougie and hold it in place for me, and then I'll suction, and then I'll take it back from them. When I take it back, I always have them let go of the bougie. I deliberately say, let go of the bougie. If someone's holding the top of your bougie, you cannot manipulate it the way you need to. You cannot bring the rotation so that the bougie's end that's sticking out of the patient actually needs to rotate to be almost parallel to the ground to use the bougie effectively. If someone's holding that up in the air, I can't do that, and I can't place the bougie, and that's caused a lot of difficulties passing it. So those are two tips right there. Preload in the mouth, and as soon as you are ready to use the bougie, they have to let go of it. Tell your team member, let go of the bougie. If you need to suction, tell them, grab the top of the bougie, and train people on a simulator to work well together on this beforehand. All right, so that's the first thing is, I think if that bougie preloading technique was done, they might have been able to get that bougie in on that first pass. They couldn't get the tube in because the patient was desatting too much. But if they had that bougie in, what I do on these patients next is I have a swivel adapter available. And I don't try to pass the tube at this point if the patient's sat is dropping. Instead, what I do is I put the CPAP mask back on, I thread the bougie through the CPAP mask, and that swivel adapter allows the bougie to pop out of the top. But it's an airtight seal, and I'll put a picture of these in the show notes. But what this allows you to do is reoxygenate before passing the tube. You have a bougie through the cords. It's being held in there by that swivel adapter. You can reoxygenate the patient, and then when they're reoxygenated, take off the mask again, hold the bougie in place, and now intubate over it. Now, my friend Jim DeCanto does the same thing when he's using the oscillator. So that's, you know, tip number three, is have a swivel adapter on any of these difficult airways that need CPAP pre-oxygenation. It allows you to keep the bougie in, reoxygenate, take it off, and then pass the tube. All right, so that's tip three. Now, let's get back to the case. They're saying the sats were plummeting, so they aborted the attempt. At this point, they made the determination, since during the awake look they could see the cords, that they should paralyze the patient. Now, there's no right answer in this case. You might say, well, if you saw it, maybe we should keep him breathing and just try again. We now know we could see cords. We could get a bougie in there. Or paralyzing is okay. I think either choice is okay. It has to be determined by the physician on the ground. But what I would say is, if you are going to do paralysis, there's a way I go about it in these cases. I've identified this as an incredibly high-risk patient that we're now going to paralyze because we think it'll give us the optimal chance of getting that tube in. This is a situation that Ron Walls and the folks from the emergency airway class are now calling a forced-to-act situation. You see, by strict interpretation of the previous difficult airway course guidelines, this patient would already be mandatory surgical cricothyrotomy before you had any attempts at intubation, because that's just the way the algorithms are written. Now, obviously, that doesn't make much sense. You should probably give a shot at maximal optimizing of one intubation attempt. And so they've understood that, and now they've changed their paradigm to what's called forced to act. In a patient you can't get the oxygen sat up before you even start, you paralyze and get one attempt at RSI intubation. And that, I say that again, one attempt is what happens with forced to act. And if that one attempt fails, then you proceed to cricothyrotomy. And there's no additional attempts. You could try things while the cric is going on, but the forced act paradigm tells you you have to proceed to surgical cric. Now, you could debate whether that's ideal or not. I think it's a pretty good idea as just a paradigm to consider that. To consider that there shouldn't be multiple attempts if you are giving paralysis with a patient you already can't oxygenate before you start. Obviously, I substitute CPAP pre-oxygenation before I get to that point. They were doing that in this case. It wasn't working. And so now I think they're in a forced-to-act situation, which means if you're not going to cric after the first attempt, certainly you're going to start your cric during the next few attempts. Now, in the case they had, there was actually a few attempts before the decision was made to go to cricothyrotomy. There was that first attempt at paralyzed intubation, which is now attempt number two. There was one awake attempt, now a paralyzed attempt. And then there was a attempt at a LMA supreme, and then a intubating LMA, and at that point they criced, and the patient was at that point bradying down, and they had to do the cric while the patient was imminently coding or had actually coded. Now, this is where I'm going to introduce the second big concept I want to talk to you about, and it's the idea of cric-con. Now, this is based on the same ideas that went into DEFCON. If you don't know what that is in the U.S., it used to be when they were talking about alert posture for going to war, they would give you a DEFCON rating. And DEFCON 5 basically was everything is chill, no worries, no fear. And DEFCON 1 was nuclear war was imminent. They've since gotten rid of this, but I think the idea is applicable to cricothyrotomy. Let me tell you how this works.
So there are five levels. Cricon level 5 is you've discussed with the team that if you fail at your other difficult airway maneuvers and this patient turns out to be unexpectedly hard, that you will then go to cricothyrotomy. And if at any point during the intubation you can no longer oxygenate the patient, you will move to cricothyrotomy. So you've had the discussion. You feel to make sure the patient's cricothyroid anatomy is reasonable. And that way you know ahead of time whether this is going to be a valid solution or not. And that you have a cricothyrotomy kit within eye shot, meaning it might be in your difficult airway cart, but you've checked that at the beginning of the shift and you know it's there. But you know where the equipment is immediately. No one has to go looking for it. You could say immediately, open the bottom drawer of the airway kit because I need the cricothyrotomy set. Or if you've subscribe to what Darren and I believe, you have a scalpel, a bougie, and a finger in immediate proximity, and preferably a 5.5 tube or a 6 trach. That's Cricon level 5. That's every single airway I do. We're at that level. There's no level less than that for me. If I'm doing an airway, we've discussed the fact that cric might be the end, and I know where a kit is, and I felt the membrane. Krykon level 4 in a patient who may be a difficult airway. With my industrial Sharpie, and if you don't know why I use that, see my ASEP lecture. But an industrial Sharpie, I mark from the thyroid membrane to the bottom, I'm sorry, from the thyroid cartilage to the bottom of the cricoid cartilage, at one vertical mark directly in the midline. That's where I'm making my cut. If necessary, I just mark it out with the Sharpie. And I have the kit at the bedside. Kit's still closed, but it's at the bedside. A trach is at the bedside closed. That's Krykon level 4. That's in a patient who I think is a difficult airway. The site is now marked. Beyond the fact that I'm going to save the time of having to locate where I'm going to cut, everyone in the room knows if that mark is there, this may progress to Krykon. Krykon level 3. This is a patient who we've either failed attempts on a difficult airway, or I have a high suspicion this is going to be really, really tough. This is in my standard awake intubation. This is a patient I'm more worried about. This is a patient who I can't oxygenate, but I'm deciding to push paralytics because I want to take one attempt at RSI before I progress to cricothyrotomy. At Krykon level 3, I have already done everything above. I have injected 2% lidocaine with epinephrine at the site I'm going to make the cut and in the subcutaneous tissue below it. That means if I do have to cut, I'm going to have less bleeding. The site is now prepped with betadine. I've opened the cricothyrotomy set and have a scalpel in my sterile gloved hands. So now, only at this point, at full progression of Krykon level 3, would I paralyze a patient I can't oxygenate beforehand. Because now all I have to do is look up from the top of the airway and tell the person who has the scalpel, or if I'm the person with the scalpel, the person at the head only has to tell me, go. And I am ready to make the cut at the mark I've already made, that I've already infiltrated with lidocaine with epi, that I've already prepped with betadine. There is no barrier to me performing the cricothyrotomy. That is Krykon level 3. Krykon level 2 is I'm actually making the skin cut and I'm finding the membrane with my finger. I'm dissecting with my finger through the subcutaneous tissue. It doesn't mean I'm going to perform the cricothyrotomy. I've now progressed to this point and I'm holding tight at Krykon level 2. When am I going to do this? In a patient who we couldn't oxygenate, we decided to paralyze and they're failing oxygenation. They're going to keep trying up from above, and they very well might immediately, you know, get an LMA in a second later. All of a sudden, the patient's SAT's coming up, or they finally found the cords, and they're passing the tube. But my finger is on that membrane, ready to go. Krykon level 2. And there's very little force to get me to go from Krykon level 2 to Krykon level 1 in these situations, which is perform the cricothyrotomy. Actually, incising the membrane, I'm passing the bougie, because the only crics I do now, thank you, Darren, are bougie-guided, bougie-aided, bougie-assisted cricothyrotomy. That's it. And so those are the five levels. Every patient gets level 5. Difficult airway that I'm doing awake intubation gets level 4. A patient who can't be oxygenated, who we're going to take one attempt at RSI, level 3. Patient who they're failing attempts at above, the oxygen sat's not great, but you know they're telling me they're right there, they're about to get it. I am making that skin cut and finding the membrane, leaving my finger on it before I cut the membrane is Krykon level 2. Krykon level 1, Krykon the patient. All right, so let's get back to the case.
So based on what I just told you, at the point they decided to paralyze, in my mind, there is no level you could be at except at least Krykon 3, meaning that everything is prepped, the site is both marked with the Sharpie and prepped with betadine. I have someone who already has surgical gloves on and a scalpel in their hand. And at that point, I would push the paralytics. If that first attempt failed, I've now moved to Krykon 2, meaning they could take additional attempts if they want. They could try standard laryngoscopy. They could try LMA placement. They could do whatever they want up top. But I've moved now to Krykon 2. I have now cut skin. I'm dissecting with my finger to find membrane. And now at this point, with my finger on the membrane, I could look up. And depending on what they're doing up top, I could decide to progress to Krykon 1, meaning I'm going to cut the membrane, pass my bougie, or if they're saying, oh no, I see cords, just hold on 1 second. All right, I'll give them another second with my finger on the membrane. I'm holding at Krykon 2. But if there's anything going on up above, that's it. Forget it. Cricon 1, cut the membrane. Now, up until the point you cut the membrane, you've caused no real damage to this patient. There's no risk of tracheitis. There's no risk of anything except they're going to have a small scar. And if you made your cut nicely, it's going to be a really small scar. So you really have lost nothing except a tiny cut. Trust me, it is worth that tiny cut at Cricon 2. Once you incise the membrane, you still really haven't caused any problem. If you want to progress to cutting the membrane and then stop with the bougie in the trachea, all right, that's not a worry either. You could go all the way to Cricon 1 past the bougie, not past the tube. If they tell you, no, I got it. And you decide, okay, well, I'm going to hold off not past the tube. Once that bougie is in the trachea, I know where I'm going to be able to go with this. It's very easy. But at the point the decision was made to paralyze this patient with a SAD of maximal 70%, I am at least at Cricon 3. The first time they fail in that paralyzed attempt, I am at Cricon 2. That skin is cut. My finger is now on membrane. And the momentum to get me to cut through that membrane is, I can't even tell you, like a feather would fall on me and I'm now cutting the membrane. And that would be happening as they were continuing these above attempts. Because the worst thing that will happen is I'll cut the membrane and they'll have just gotten through the intimating LMA. They'll pass the tube. Okay. What damage has really been caused here? If you know what you're doing, your midline, there's really very little you could do that's going to cause lasting damage to this patient. And if you want to call ENT and let them do the repair of your skin incision, then they're going to tell you that the trach's going to close on its own. And they're just going to maybe wash out the skin a little. And if you did it with Betadine, you don't even need that. But they're going to wash out the skin and close it. Or you could close it yourself and just call ENT and say, do me a favor, follow up on this crike site. It was an aborted crike. We managed to get it just at the last moment. Just take a look at them the next day. Make sure that site looks okay. They'll do it. It's not a big deal for them. But that's the only things I could really think to add to this case. Now, one additional tip is they're going to be bagging or LMA bagging throughout your crike attempt. You better be wearing eye protection, because the second you incise that membrane, there will be an explosion of blood and spit directly in your face. So always, always, when you're getting ready for crike, when you're getting the Cricon conditioning, have the person wearing a mask and an eye shield. All right. Now, the last point I'll make is in Darren's case, even after they got the crike in and they put the patient on the ventilator, there wasn't an immediate improvement in the SAT. That's not surprising, because in order to get this guy to improve, you got to probably knock his PEEP up to 25 or 30 and leave him there for 10 or 15 minutes before you're going to see any re-recruitment, any improvement in the SATs. So this was an incredibly hard case. Just to review what we talked about, consider preloading the bougie in the mouth at the level of the right molars. It's going to cut down on the time and cut down on having to move your field of vision off those cords. And then consider always deciding what Cricon level you're at and moving down to level 3 or 2 in difficult airways, and have very little need to have a lot of push to get to Cricon 1. All right, last stuff we're going to talk about. My friend Seth Manoick, an ED intensivist who just graduated from both an anesthesia critical care fellowship followed by an internal medicine critical care fellowship, had a few comments about recent shows. The first comment he makes is that LMAs were never meant to be inflated to what the manufacturer says. Neither Seth nor I can figure out why the manufacturer has such high recommendations, but they're not good. They've turned the LMA into a very rigid device. It doesn't match the anatomy of the airway very well. We use very little inflation. And I've told you on previous shows, from the Cook AirQ, which is the device I use, the Cook AirQ intubating LMA, I put 3 cc's in the 3.5 size, about 4 5 cc's in the 4.5 size, which I think is 10 to 15 cc's less than the manufacturer recommends. And this leads to very soft, very moldable LMA. This is much less likely, I think, to impinge upon the carotids, if there is any impingement in humans, after that Nicholas Siegel study we talked about a few weeks ago. And it also seals better. So consider that. I agree absolutely with Seth on that one. The manufacturer recommendations are crazy, I think. Next thing we talked about. He says groin lines are okay for dialysis. Use ultrasound, of course, but groin lines are okay for dialysis. Absolutely agree, Seth. The literature says much safer for dialysis catheters than for regularly used catheters. Why? Well, because these dialysis nurses are only using it for dialysis, and they use meticulous sterile technique, far more sterile than we do in the ED and even sometimes in the ICU. So yes, great source for dialysis line, and that's where I put most of my dialysis lines. Do not use the subclavian if there's any other site for a dialysis temporary catheter, because if you clot off the subclavian, that arm is now gone for any fistulae or shunts later on in the patient's course. So yeah, absolutely. And he says, use ultrasound. Absolutely agree for that femoral line. He in his career has seen about 10 retroperitoneal bleeds, and one patient was killed by a retroperitoneal bleed from a femoral line. So his experience matches mine. These are deadly lines in the wrong hands. But if you use ultrasound and you're using it for a dialysis cath, good stuff. But he goes further, and he says, man up or woman up. Well, he actually used the language a little bit stronger, but we won't say that on the podcast. And just put in the subclavian. Forget about ultrasound guided unless you're insanely good at ultrasound. You're more likely to cause a pneumo with ultrasound guided. I agree with that, too. But subclavian is even safer than IJ. IJ could still clot, could still get an infection. He says, just man or woman up, and just learn to place subclavian lines. They're the quickest. They're the easiest. You don't need ultrasound. The anatomy is consistent. It doesn't collapse when the patient's shocked. Just learn to do that line. We're losing that skill in emergency medicine, and I agree with you, Seth. And then the last thing he talks about is he says for him, if he had a submassive PE, he'd want the TPA, just like I did in a bunch of comments on other people's blogs, and I think I mentioned it on the show as well. We don't know if it affects mortality in the submassive PE. What we do know is that your exercise tolerance, your risk of pulmonary hypertension down the line, your lifestyle is markedly improved with TPA. And if you're young, you probably want it. Now, on Rob Orman's EM Wrap in July, he had the best interview with Jeff Klein on PE I've ever heard. And what came out of that interview is, for Jeff Klein, you know, the master of PE, the PE man for emergency medicine, he says, submassive PE, which means signs of right-sided heart failure, whether it be troponin, BNP, echocardiographic evidence, brief hypotension, non-sustained hypotension, all these fit in the submassive category, very low oxygen sats despite oxygen, so you know, around 90% on oxygen, somewhere in that range. He says for young patients, it should be a no-brainer. To not give them it is almost a failing. If they have no contraindications. So he says young, less than 40 years old, thereabouts, you can send him, you tell him, look, you're not going to be able to do much in the way of athletic activities. You're not going to have your normal life without getting rid of this huge clot. Consider it. And let them make the choice, obviously, but tell them the risk of intracranial hemorrhage, life-threatening hemorrhage is less than 1%. It's probably a lot less than that, but it's definitely less than 1%. And if it was him, when he was still less than 40, he would take it. He says in the old patients, greater than 75 to 80 is what I could extrapolate from that discussion, don't give it unless, you know, they're really getting bad. They're getting to the point where they're now considered the massive category. Don't give it. That they're the ones who are going to bleed. And then in that, you know, 40 to 75 range, it's equipoise. Ask the patient what they want based on your interpretation of the best available evidence because the risk-benefit is a little tougher in that category. All right, I've already gone over my 20 minutes, and I've already gone way over the 5 minutes I normally do for wheeze, but I think this is important stuff. I wanted to get this out there. One last thing I want to mention, and I'm sorry for running over, but I want to do an art contest because I have no artistic skills at all, but you folks might. So I want to do an art contest. The winner is going to get a copy of Mike Winter's resuscitation book from ASEP, which is phenomenal. I'll have a link to that book in the show notes, but I'll get you a copy of that if you submit some high-quality drawing of what you envision as the MCRIT mascot. What does the MCRIT mascot look like? When you hear MCRIT, what do you think about? I know in my mind, I got a little impish devil with a laryngoscope in his hand. Looks a little bit malevolent, but, you know, has some goodness in his heart. And that's what I think about when I think about MCRIT. But you don't have to be tied to that. You interpret MCRIT however you like. What would a mascot look like? And if you draw that and you send it in, I'm going to pick the top three with my MCRIT team, and then I'm going to put them on the site and let you folks vote. And whoever wins, I'm going to send you a copy of Mike Winter's book. It's such a good book. I got a chapter in there, but that's not why I'm saying it's good. I'm saying it's good because it's probably the best guide to resuscitation in the emergency department currently available. That's until I write mine. So for now, that's the one I recommend. Love, love this book. So if you know how to draw and you're able to submit it to me, you could scan it in. You can mail it if you don't know how to scan. Scanning's a lot easier. But the full details in the show notes. But if you could draw, please submit something. I'd love to see what you have in your mind as the mascot for MCRIT. All right. Now we're really at the bye-bye point. So Scott Weingart, MCRIT Podcast, saying bye-bye.